This is the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Three-pointer.
Oh, Huggins! Double honor!
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow! In your life have you seen anything like that?
Oh! LeBron James with no regard for human life!
Welcome to the AA Podcast.
Maddie, what are you still doing here?
Here's Matt Yoder.
We welcome into this week's AA Podcast, the star of the new Fox Sports 1 show, Garbage Time with Katie Nolan. And I think the only way to introduce you, Katie, is an ode to your former partner in crime, Regis Philbin, as the girl blowing up the internet. Katie Nolan joins us. Welcome to the AA Podcast.
Thank you for having me. That was a lovely introduction.
Tell me, what trade offers have come in for you this week?
I'm entertaining a lot of different deals. We've got something going on with sci-fi, thinking about something for Sharknado 2, some sort of a trade-off, or Sharknado 3, or like an option for Sharknado 4 with a guest role. I've got a lot on the table. You know, it's the hot stove of my off-season, so.
That'd be awesome. I like that sci-fi deal. I was wondering here if ESPN might trade whatever was left of Rick Riley for you, or like a Peter King deal with SI or something like that.
It's a good three-way deal.
I think that would be perfect. That'd be the way to do it, three-way dance. All right, let's start on a more serious note about your journey here, because it's really something that I think is quite extraordinary, at least when you look at it in terms of being really non-traditional. So for those people that don't quite know your backstory, how exactly did you get to Fox Sports 1?
Well, first, I don't think there's anyone who reads Awful Announcing that doesn't know my backstory, because you guys do a fantastic job of making sure people know who I am, which thank you for that.
Which carries some very good things. You know, there's always good comments. But it's kind of funny, Katie, there are people like in our comments section that are very obsessed with any time there's any news or viral video or whatever that we publish surrounding one of your works or this new show. There's always those people that, more so than anyone else, that are obsessed with like tearing down Katie Nolan, that think we have this Katie Nolan like obsession. I was like,
an agenda.
The Katie Nolan agenda, that's what it is, as if it is part of some vast right-wing conspiracy that we, as Awful Announcing, a sports media news and information site, is publishing information about this person who has, you know, a very visible career in sports media, that is some kind of agenda/conspiracy.
Yeah, I've been paying you guys every week. I'm sorry that your check this week bounced, but if you could just still keep posting about me, that would be fantastic. That way we can continue our plan for world domination.
Of course. And, you know, not that, you know, exposing it in this podcast would ruin those plans, but, you know, we just like to keep throwing the curveballs out there.
Yeah, exactly. So. To answer your actual question, I would say, what was your actual question? How did I get here?
Aside from the world domination plans, how did you get to this very important step of Garbage Time as a part of that larger
long story? But I will tell you the very short version. I graduated college with a major degree in PR. I couldn't find a job. I moved back home to Boston and bartended for a while, and then got really bored, so I started writing a blog. And then another blog found my blog and wanted me to write for them, and then they wanted me to do a daily video show, and I had no experience. And so for 2 years, I did 5 days a week, completely self-produced, self-written, self-researched content. I made 5 videos a week about news and comedy, and then Fox Sports found me and said they were launching a new network, and they had an idea for me, but they weren't really sure how they would use me. And then I auditioned, and it really didn't go very well. And they ended up offering me this job to monitor social media and, like, you know, check in on Twitter a couple times throughout a show called Crowd Goes Wild that was going to be hosted by Regis Philbin. And you don't say no to that, because what? That's weird. So I did, and then I moved from the couch. I ended up being a panelist, so I was, I think, the 18th panelist on Crowd Goes Wild.
Give or take.
And then after that show, unfortunately, met its demise. I went back to doing internet videos. We called it No Filter, and then we did it 3 times a week, and then we did it 5 days a week, and then we went to 2 days a week. And then we sort of came up with this idea of what if we made something kind of like The Daily Show for television and sort of incorporated what we do with No Filter, but made it a late night TV show. And after some deliberation, Fox was like, cool, let's try it. And so here we are at Garbage Time.
Wow. Did you come up with that name, or how did the name come about? I'm curious.
I did. We actually, really? We had come up with a bunch of names before that we were playing around with. I think we had Laser Show with Katie Nolan. That was a one we were probably going to use. And then we were doing a brainstorm session for something else. And I was just, you know, when you think about something so much that you just need to sort of shut your brain off and like look at a list of words. I don't know if you've ever had this happen.
Every day, pretty much blogging.
Googled like, you know, sports phrases. So I'm just like looking through the list and looking through the list. And then I'm like, there's other phrases I use that aren't on this list. I was like garbage time. And I was like, wait, that makes perfect sense. Like garbage time is at the end of the game. And like, we're at the end of the week. We're airing on a Sunday. And so there's not really anything I can say to add to the news of the week, but I still want to say things. So it'll matter to me what I say, but it might not matter to anybody else. It, like, the more I thought about it, like, I'm a rookie with no experience. Garbage Time was the perfect name. And at first people were like, I think that might have a negative connotation. And I said, yeah, it does. And it should. So I think we should do Garbage Time. And it stuck.
It's perfect. Some of your friends, some of the old guard New York media scribes, were definitely big fans of that name.
Yeah, they're huge fans of me. I think they love new media. I don't know if you saw, but Raceman now has like a daily or a weekly video that he's doing.
I saw he was tagging you in those videos.
Yeah, he tags me every time he does one, which is like really strange, because if you think that I'm if you don't like what I do, then why do you want my followers?
I think you found your first guess for Garbage
Time. Yeah, I really should try to book him.
That'd be fantastic.
We film pretty late. He's probably at like a early bird special or something. He's tucked in by the time our show's on.
Yeah, that's not one I'm going to touch with a 10-foot pole. Okay, back to your journey here. I think one thing that stands out is, you know, there's so many people that have so many sports blogs everywhere. But that transition to video and doing what you did at Gaiism, that's kind of, I think, how you made your mark and began to stand out. Now, you said you didn't have any experience with that, and it was all self-done. What was that transition like, and what were the biggest challenges in going into video and then doing that consistently?
The transition was really tough when my boss at the time, Chris Staggs, he approached me about it, and I said no. I said immediately, my immediate answer was absolutely not. I was like, I don't do on camera. I've never done on camera. I'm much more comfortable writing something and then being able to, you know, proofread it, rewrite it. Once you do something on video, it's there and you can't really change it. It seemed like too much work and I couldn't do it. And he was like, you know, I really think you should just try. Just please try. And so we had like a week where I tried it out and it was so awful. And, he sort of was working with me. I'm like, okay, try to fix this and try to do that. And originally we were filming them on like a MacBook webcam. And so it wasn't exactly a huge production, but once I started to, you know, get things going, I got my feet on the ground. I started to realize, like, I'm competing on YouTube with these other shows that do the same thing, but they have graphics and they have great editing and they're in green screens. And so once I started to figure out the joke writing and that started to become a little bit easier, and, you know, finding the headlines, I started to get kind of the system down. Then I started to think, if these are going to be successful, I really have to step up my game. So I went out and bought a green screen, which is interesting.
You went out and bought your own green screen?
Yeah,
for those videos.
I bought a green screen, and it was a very cheap one. It wasn't very good. It was like basically a fleece blanket, but it was green, which I think is the important part. And I bought a bunch of lights, and I just I looked on YouTube for videos of how to properly light a video. I basically taught myself, and then I watched YouTube videos to learn how to use Final Cut Pro, because at the time I was using iMovie, which is a great program, but it just couldn't do all the things I needed it to do. And so then over the course of like a year, it went from being these really low budget, crappy videos with bad jokes to being like really nice looking videos that still had kind of crappy jokes. So, I mean, it was interesting because I guess the hardest challenge was being the face of something, you know, because mm-hmm. when I woke up and was writing a blog every day, it didn't matter what I looked like. I didn't really even have to shower. I just had to write things that were funny.
Which is one of the great, great things of blogging, by the way. It's just the general laziness that you
can. And not showering.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then I all of a sudden had to look presentable. And then also I started to notice people were judging me on what I looked like. And it was like, well, when I was blogging, it was so much easier because I could just write a joke and nobody would write, you didn't even write this joke, or shut up and show me your boobs. It's like I just want to kind of go back to being, like, faceless. It was so much easier back then. But
wow. Not that women in sports media as a whole have to deal with any of those things or on Twitter or anything like that. I'm curious.
Oh, yeah, never.
I'm curious, you know, I thought out of all the videos that you've done, No Filter especially, that was definitely the strongest work. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on this whole Curt Schilling debate where he stood up for his daughter, all the abuse that they were getting on Twitter. And to me, that is kind of shining a light on this sort of darker side of social media. I mean, we all use it. We all love it. But in talking to a lot of people that work in this kind of corner of the world in sports media, it almost seems like everyone's agreed that, yeah, Twitter's kind of becoming a more nasty place. So I don't know if you've experienced that as well in the past maybe year, that there's more and more what call them trolls, call them haters, what have you. Or do you think it's just, you know, hey, we have to accept this as people that live in the public eye that, yeah, you know, you're going to get the good with the bad when it comes to social media.
I hate to say that we have to accept it because I think that quickly brushes off the responsibility that people should have as humans to be better humans. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, you know, social media has a great side of it and it's amazing and wonderful. And then it's got the complete opposite where it's awful and it's evil and it's sort of crazy that the yin and the yang both exist. They're in this one medium. It's very fascinating and I could talk or think about Twitter for hours and I usually do. I think what I've noticed actually recently is that I'm seeing less of the awful on Twitter and more of the awful in comment sections on blogs. And I think it's sort of going to be like a fluid, I think we're going to see changes like this across different social media platforms throughout time. Sort of like a fluid change of, okay, well right now the hot spot for being nasty to people is on Twitter. And right now the hot spot for being nasty on people, because I think when people are nasty to you or when they say awful things, it's when they are feeling comfortable to do so. Mm-hmm. And so I think on Twitter, if somebody has a sense of, you know what, it's okay for me to tweet this occasional one because I see someone else is doing it, so I'm going to pile on. That's when you start to see so many. Like, if one of those guys hadn't tweeted something to Curt Schilling's daughter, then I don't think a lot of them would have. I think once someone sees another guy doing it, and then another guy doing it, then Curt Schilling responds to it, and it becomes a national story. You would think that would make people go, stop doing it, but it's actually making some people think, oh, I'll do it too. Like, why not? I want Curt Schilling to tweet at me. That would be great. And I think with blog comment sections, I notice a lot of the time, it's the same people commenting on the same blog, so it makes this sense of community. And then you start to see, once they get really comfortable, they start trying to outdo each other with the nasty things they can say. So I think it's got to be some sort of, like, psychological something that I probably would love to study but just don't have time to think about people on Twitter and in social media and what makes them think they can say the awful things that they say to some people. But I think as a society we have to start, I don't know, accepting when a person in the public eye goes after one of their trolls. What's interesting to me about the Curt Schilling story too is that, you know, he's standing up for his daughter and he's doing a really great thing. Generally, I mean, at least at first, when the story first broke, everybody was praising him for doing that. What a great dad, and he's going after these guys, and good for him. But a lot of the times when I respond to my trolls on Twitter, people are like, don't engage them, leave them alone, like, just answer to the nice ones. Why do you only respond to the negative ones? So I think people need to stop condemning others who stand up for themselves. Like, I know if you do it too much, it ends up looking really petty, but try to put yourself, I think everybody would be better off if we all put ourselves in each other's shoes a lot more often.
If everyone got trolled just for like one 24-hour period, just to know.
Like every time you check your Twitter, just to see the nice things, you also see the mean things. You really can't control that, and if somebody says something about you that's untrue, it's human nature to be like, wait a second, that's not the truth. So just, you know, I think everybody sort of needs to lay off everybody else on Twitter.
The blog comment thing is interesting because I've kind of bandied this back and forth in my own mind. Like, is it still worth it to have blog comments? And, you know, I've thought about getting rid of comment sections because, you know,
you gotta keep them.
It's not like we get a ton of comments, but any second that you have to go in and like delete a racist or sexist comment or whatever, like, it's just such a waste of time to do that. So why bother? But then you think, you know, do you really want to shut that down and throw out the good with, you know, the jerks that are in there and the sounds and the insights in the comments? And do you want to shut down that public forum and that immediate response to your work? I know a lot of websites have kind of gone in that direction, but I don't know, that's interesting that you hear that you see more nastiness there, because I think that's, as someone that runs a website, I mean, that's a conversation that we've had for quite a while. Is there still value in that? And do you basically get rid of the whole thing just because a few people ruin it?
Yeah, I mean, even though I feel like that's where people have tended to be the nastiest, I still think you have to keep your comment section, because anytime I read an article and I scroll down, I mean, I'm scrolling down to see, oh, this is interesting and I don't have a stance on this. Let me see what the opposition is reacting to this article. Like, what's the argument against what this article is arguing? And yeah, you see some awful stuff down there, but you also see the stuff that helps you balance out that article. And I think whenever I see an article of someone saying like their very strong opinion, you shouldn't do this, or this sucks and is awful and this is what it should be, and there's no comment section on the article, it's just your first thought is like, well, that's cowardly. How can I react to you? How can I let you know what I think if you're not even going to let me comment on your article?
Yeah. Interesting. So, how can I tell you that?
I don't know. That's the thing. It's like, I don't know how to fix it. I can tell you very much what the problem is because I interact with it on a pretty daily basis. I don't know how we all fix it other than look at yourself in the mirror and say, hey, me, be less of a shithead.
And you can't say that word on this podcast, by the way.
Oh, man. Sorry.
It's good. You know, this is the unrated version. your no filter videos, specifically, when you get like a real kind of fiery, passionate take, like at a Rick Riley or a Peter King, obviously those videos made the rounds. What is the process of putting that together? I mean, do you just see when Peter King is trying to make this Darren Sharper Hall of Fame stand and say, you know what, this is something I've got to spend 4 minutes ripping to shreds? Or Rick Riley and Regis Philbin? How does that entire creative process come together for those videos?
I'll speak more to the Peter King one than the Rick Riley one, because that one was for Crowd Goes Wild, so we had a lot of production involved in that. And I didn't have much to say over what made the show and what didn't. But for No Filter, for Peter King, every day that we did No Filter, we have a Google document that myself and my two producers have access to. And so we'll just throw in all the major headlines of the day, and we'll kind of look over them and start to throw out ideas of like, oh, if we did a No Filter based on this, we could say this about it, or if we said this, we could go this angle. And I was reading I saw the Peter King reaction on Twitter at first, and I was like, what? This guy just out of nowhere was taking what a weird thing to be like, I'll take a stance on Sharper when no one's really talking about it. Seems sort of strange. So I sort of dug through and read his article, and as I was writing it, reading it in the Google document, I was just like free flow, like vomiting my thoughts into this document. And then I went to sleep, and I woke up the next morning, and I came into work thinking we were going to do a silly video, and one of the producers was like, so you want to go that Peter King angle? And I was like, well, it would be a little bit more serious. I'd have to throw some jokes into my, because everything I'd been ranting was just like, F this guy, and oh my God, and it wasn't like funny, it was sort of just me being angry at his opinion. So then I sat with it for like 3 hours, and I kind of took out all the stuff that didn't make any sense, and sliced in some jokes, and then read it back to my producers, and they're like, that works, but we don't have a teleprompter, so we had to sort of make that work by propping the laptop underneath the camera so that I could try to read what I wrote. Because I sort of have this way of blacking out sometimes when I'm on camera. If I'm, like, doing something important, I need to just read off the teleprompter. It's kind of Ron Burgundy of me, but it helps to have the teleprompter there in case I just completely lose my train of thought.
That would really, you know, if you're looking for a way to get the premiere to really be a viral hit, a Ron Burgundy moment, I mean, that would do it.
I mean, it'll probably happen accidentally, most likely, just, you know, if you put something in the teleprompter. I'll read it, and halfway through, we'll go, wait a second.
But if you could time it, if you could time it for the premiere, that would obviously be optimal.
Yeah.
So
that would be interesting.
That's really interesting, though, to hear how that process evolves, because I think a lot of people would just see, you know, the 4-minute video, but not think about the hours of work that goes into it, and writing the material and editing the material and putting all that stuff in there. I'm curious if there's one video or essay or, you know, something that you created that you've put together, whether it be at No Filter or back at Guyism or Crowd Goes Wild, that you would say is a work that you're most proud of?
That's interesting because it's a bunch of very different apples and oranges to compare, you know? So, like, I'm very proud of the Ray Rice domestic violence video that we made, because that was a point that I don't think anyone had made, and I was proud of myself for making it and working on it and putting it out there. I mean, I went back and forth on whether or not we should post that video a bunch of times, because I didn't know if it was too serious. I wanted to try it again. I wanted to do another take with some more jokes or with maybe more laughing, and I didn't know if I was ready yet to straddle the balance of the serious and funny, and I didn't know if people would get angry at it or if people would think I was making the issue about myself when that wasn't my point. So I had a lot of going back and forth on that, but I'm proud that we did put it out there, and I stand by that. So I'm proud of that, but also, you know, I'm proud of when I put a cookie on my face and I managed to get it into my mouth. Like, that is a really proud moment for me.
There's different kinds of proud. There's different
dimensions. Yeah, it's hard to, you know, it's like picking from your children which one's my favorite. It's difficult.
See if you can answer this question for me, Katie. I want to transition into more of your TV work now. What exactly was Crowd Goes Wild?
Oh, wow. That's a great question.
From an existential, philosophical point of view.
Ay. I don't think anyone can define Crowd Goes Wild. Crowd Goes Wild was a show with a big idea, and a lot of people trying to make it work that genuinely wanted it to and genuinely believed in it, but it also had a lot, it had an uphill battle to fight. It was an idea that maybe was a little bit too off the beaten path, let's say, for like a new sports network. And so then there was a little bit of pushback of, oh no, we need to get back to sports. And we were all sort of happy with going a little bit off the trail. I loved Crowd Goes Wild. I know people say that it was awful, and sometimes it was. There were times I went home and was like, I'm going to pretend that didn't happen. But the beauty of that was I woke up the next day and I had to go back to work and do another episode. The things I liked about Crowd Goes Wild will probably show up in my show. So get excited, everyone who hated Crowd Goes Wild, because it will. The memory of it, the ghost of it, will live on.
You can keep it alive in some kind of spiritual form. I'm curious.
Exactly.
You said, you know, you started that show doing social media. I'm interested to know what exactly a social media person does on a television show, because, I mean, we see that a lot of places, and all I can think about is the poor person who was at the ESPYs last year, who was the social media correspondent,
yeah,
and ended up, like, on every sports blooper reel that there was.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, you know, what exactly a social media correspondent does per se.
I'll give you my complete honest answer, and keep in mind that I was only the social media correspondent for I think a week or a week and a half of that show, so it could be more than what it ended up being for me. But first of all, we wanted to do something called Connect Live. It was a program that was going to allow us to ask questions that would show up on the lower third of your TV at home, and then viewers could vote by using their tablets or their cell phones. That ended up being really hard to execute actually live. So they had it look like I was asking the question of the audience and typing it into Connect Live, but there was a producer in the green room or in the control room doing that. So I was just reading the question and then monitoring the answers on Connect Live on the bottom of the screen. There was also tweets, but they all have to be legally approved before you can read them on the air. So it wasn't like I was scrolling through Twitter and just reading tweets off of my computer, because we have to get them through standards and practices, and then those have to be approved. So the job of social media correspondent was pretty easy. It was only difficult because I had never been on TV before, and I didn't know I needed glasses, and I had a teleprompter I had to read off of, and I couldn't read it. So that was the only part of that job that was really that difficult. It was sort of useless, and I think that's why we got rid of it, because I think I'm too cynical to play the role that I think they sort of had planned on me playing. Like, hey everyone, let's check in on Twitter, and I couldn't do it. It was like, I would say to the producers every meeting, like, can I stop saying I'm checking on Twitter when these tweets are obviously from like 3 hours ago? I was real, and they were like, Katie, it's TV, this is how it works, you just have to pretend. And I was like, do I have to? And then it was like, okay, we've either got to fire Katie, or we could just move her to the panel and let her talk and keep Trevor Price in line. So I think that's what they opted for.
Obviously, it worked out for the best. Okay, give me your best Regis Philbin story.
Oh, my best Regis Philbin story. There's so many. I don't want to tell him, that would embarrass him.
All right, the best Regis Philbin story that you could safely tell in public that would not embarrass him?
I would say the coolest Regis Philbin story for me, maybe not the best story, but I was sitting on a couch backstage outside of his dressing room, which was like three times the size of the one I shared with Georgie Thompson. And he came in, walked past me on the couch, sat down, put his arm around me, was like, what are you doing, kid? And I was like, oh, I'm just writing, I was at the time writing a rant that I did on the show about, I think it was the Astros did like ladies night. And so I was going to do a straight to camera rant. So I was typing it out, and he was reading it, like leaned over my computer reading it. And as I'm, you know, trying to get things done, he was just ha, 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 like belly laughing on the couch. And I said, what's so funny? And he's like, that's some good stuff. Who wrote that? And I was like, oh. Regis, I'm sitting here typing it in front of you. I wrote it. And he was like, you know, you could be the next Tina Fey. And I was like, what? What an amazing compliment. And then he followed that up by saying, because you're much cuter. Thanks, Regis.
But in like a kind, thoughtful, like grandpa kind of way, right?
Exactly. It was like a compliment, but then there was always that little jab of like, but it's only because you're cute. Like, that's, you know, because he's old, and that's how old people think.
Amen. All right, let's talk about the new show. You're building the set today, which we talked a little bit before we started taping. It's kind of funny because it's there with Men in Blazers, and I'm not sure a lot of people know that the folks producing this, Michael Davies, Embassy Row, is, of course, one half of the Men in Blazers. So yeah. I'm kind of hoping that there's going to be some crossover episodes here, where you go to Men in Blazers, they show up on Garbage Time, because, I mean, given the size of the Men in Blazers studio, it'd be like a 6-foot walk between the two, I'm guessing.
Not even. It's one room that they tape. Their cameras are angled towards one corner, and then we move all their stuff out when we film, and our camera's angled in the other corner. So where their table is exactly where my table is. It's just that my table isn't there when they're filming.
That is fantastic.
It's so small.
No expense is being paid to make this a success. I mean, everything possible. This is going to be a multi-million dollar operation, obviously.
Yeah, this is like Wayne's World of sports.
But at least this time, you don't have to look up your own YouTube videos on how to put it together, I'm guessing.
That's true. We do have people doing that, and I'm very thankful for them.
Maybe the truest sign that you finally made it, I guess. You mentioned the Daily Show idea, and we've seen kind of throughout the last decade or two, people have tried kind of that idea of a Daily Show for sports or sports soup, or John Oliver or whatever, you know, that unique brand of humor and snark that really connects with those people hasn't really worked in sports
hasn't
before.
Worked at all.
I mean, you go through Sports Soup, The Daily Line. I don't know if you want to throw Crowd Goes Wild into that. Maybe it's its own animal. How are you going to buck that trend to make sure this doesn't fall in line with those other attempts?
It's a fantastic question that I've spent a lot of time thinking about because it's strange because on paper it should work. Sports fans like humor. Most of them, you know, sports fans and athletes generally are funny people. So it's always confused me why anytime a show tries to be both, it doesn't work. I think what I've figured out in my research, at least, is that it's almost like, you know, The Daily Show, that's politics. You've got Democrats. For the most part, you've got Democrats and Republicans. You've got two audiences. And you sort of pick one and play to it. With sports, you've got so many different audiences. Everybody has a team. So anytime you make a joke, if it's about someone's team, they get defensive and they don't like it. And I think that's where sports comedy struggles, that everybody's laughing until it's about their own team and then there's backlash. So I don't know how I fix that. I think people need to sort of just relax about their teams and laugh at them. I think that would help us all out greatly. But I also think what would help is that our show is going to do, it's weird, I guess I should say my show, but it feels weird still to say my show. It's going to do more than just humor. It will also have, you know, guests, celebrity guests, and it's going to also have, you know, podcast conversations with people within the industry. So if you don't like me, that's okay. Maybe you like this person. We're going to have a conversation. I think the most important thing that our show is going to do is touch on that gray area in sports issues and even like societal issues that are reflected in sports. We're going to have conversations where we're not afraid to say, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but we'll talk through it together and kind of try to find it. I think that's sort of what's going to anchor it in being relatable to people. But in terms of how are you going to not get canceled? I don't know if I can answer that question yet, Matt. I hope I can. But I guess we're going to kind of find out together.
What do you hope to offer in an episode that might be different from anything else that's on sports TV? I mean, we've seen, you know, a lot of studio shows come and go over the past, you know, decade, especially, you know, Fox Sports 1. We've seen all the new shows roll out on that network. Now Garbage Time with Katie Nolan. So what can be different about this show, aside from, you know, the comedy angle and maybe some of the discussions that you're planning? What could be different, what could be distinguishing that could say, you know what, when this premieres Sunday night, March 15th, 9:30, this is going to pull you away from what's on ESPN or what's on NBC or Walking Dead or what have you?
I think off the top, I'm not super, I can't really concern myself with pulling you away from things you've done, things that are a habit of yours, things that, you know, you're going to watch because Game of Thrones doesn't have any commercials, whereas Garbage Time does. I can hope that you'll DVR it and give it a shot. And I guess then my goal is once someone gives it a shot, how can I get them to stick around?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I don't have an answer that I know is the correct answer per se. I just know that what we're not going to do, I guess, is easier to define than what we will do that will keep people around. But from watching sports TV and consuming sports media for so long, obviously before I was in it, so that's how I can say so long. I haven't only been consuming it since people have heard my name. It's just there's so much of, you know, talking heads debating, and this guy feels like A, and this guy feels like B, and then they fight about it. I mean, our show won't have that. I mean, maybe there will come a time where I feel so passionately and have a person on who feels so passionately the opposite, but that'll be the exception, not the rule. The rule is that it'll be a place where you can have an intelligent conversation and express your opinions, and it's a safe place, and sort of maybe learn something from a person who doesn't feel exactly what you feel, but can relate to why you feel that way. I also think we're going to have segments that are that speak to the digital audience, but don't steal from the digital audience. I think a lot of shows now, instead of creating content, pull from Twitter. They just take people's tweets and they put them on screen, and it comes off as like, write your own jokes. Don't take someone else's joke and share it. That's sort of just getting a laugh from someone else's material. So that's why I think one of our goals is to invite on a lot of the people in sports media that you laugh at when you follow on Twitter and have them actually talk and make you laugh instead of stealing their tweet and using it to fill a segment. It's going to be a really different show, I mean, aesthetically and just, you know, how it's built structurally. And I think we do have a lot to play with. It could work out that, you know, the show that it is on episode one, by the time we reach episode 15, it's a completely different show. But I think that's kind of the beauty of it, that we have so many ideas that we're willing to play with, and we sort of just have to see what fits and then roll with it. I think it's just going to be really fun, and it's certainly not going to take itself seriously because we don't have the budget for that.
But it sounds like, I mean, I think a lot of people might go into this thinking, oh, you know, this is going to kind of be an attempt at comedy that, you know, maybe it will produce some laughs, maybe it won't. But it sounds like there, you know, there might be a bit of a serious kind of informational, you know, let's talk it out edge to it that may surprise some people, I think, from what it sounds like what you're saying about the show.
I think the goal was, like, there were a lot of times on Crowd Goes Wild where we've had a really good conversation and it was, you know, we made some points that maybe people aren't making on other shows. And I think we wanted to find a way to get that. And, you know, when you're alone in a studio, I can't have a debate with a camera. So that's
you
why we
try.
Came up with the idea of bringing someone in almost as a panel. So it's kind of like a rotating panel, but it's just one person. So it's me and another person just have a rotating conversation. And I think that'll be interesting. I think the most important thing about the show is that it's more than one thing, just like people are. Nobody is just, oh, what's he like? Oh, he's funny. That's it. It's always funny, and he's smart, and he's so. Same way the show is going to be that. It's going to be kind of like a person. It's going to be me. It's going to be funny, but it's also going to have an opinion. It's going to have an intellectual opinion, and it's going to read, and it's going to share its thoughts. It's going to have a lot too. It's going to be really silly and goofy, but it's also going to. If there's something that I need to say or want to say, I have the platform to do that.
What would make Garbage Time a success in your eyes?
I think in my eyes, Garbage Time would be a success if I make $1 million. I think it would be a success if it got people talking. That is such a vague answer, but it's the truth. And it's actually how I think we're being measured by Fox Sports, because it's such a weird multi-platform show. We're going to be the first show available completely. The episodes are available online. So it'll be hard for, you know, if that's how somebody prefers to watch it, we don't get that number in ratings. And I think they've mentioned that it's going to be measured on the engagement that it has. So I think if it gets people interested, if it brings up topics that aren't being brought up elsewhere, if it gets anybody thinking about something differently than they thought about it before, that to me makes the show a success. And also if they laugh at something, if it's silly and they enjoy it and the content gets shared, that to me also would be a success.
That's interesting because, you know, I think a lot of people look at these studio shows not on ESPN because they're kind of on a different level, and it's all about ratings and viewership. But I think the lesson that, you know, those of us who write about this world and those of us who are in it have learned is that it's really, really difficult to build an audience for a standalone studio show. I mean, you look at Dan Patrick on NBC, Michelle Beadle, some of the Fox Sports 1 shows, that it's just so hard. I mean, Jim Rome on CBS is another example. It's just so hard given that what ESPN has in terms of their 35-year head start on everybody else. And the fact that they can draw, you know, 1 million viewers for basically anything, that it's sort of like a different level of success, different thresholds. So you can't really make that apples to oranges comparison. That's why I'm interested to know that, you know, success for you and the show might not be defined by how many viewers you get or what the overnight rating is, because I think for all of us, and maybe you can speak to this too, we seem to be moving into this new age where, you know, it's more than just TV. You know, it's what you do online, what you do in digital, on social media. And I think we've seen, you know, Fox, we had a story about at the buzzer today and how it's grown, especially with social media. Sports Illustrated, ESPN, NBC, all of these networks seem to be going more into this digital space, and you really see new media kind of taking over and being really what's more important, I guess, than the old way of just looking at whatever Nielsen says is doing well. So I don't know if you feel like this show may be part of that trend or what your feelings are about that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like if this were a show on ESPN, measuring success for me would be don't lose the viewer. The viewer is already there. If you're a decent enough show, the viewer's not going to change the channel. If you're a very bad show, they're going to, so don't lose the viewer. But on a network, you know, a new network like ours, then the viewer isn't probably already there. I mean, if you've got a great lead in, then maybe they're there, but you sort of have to draw them in, or you have to find them and reach them other ways. So for me, partially because I still don't understand how television ratings work, which I think is a great benefit to me.
You're blessed. But also, blessed in that regard.
Yeah, just, I guess, partially because that's not mainly a concern of mine. I mean, I'm sure it's a concern of someone's at a network, but I don't know how, if necessarily that would mean that my show is a success. I don't think that right from the start, everyone's going to go, oh, it's 9:30, changing the channel, putting on Fox Sports 1 for garbage time. And I think people watch TV and consume television shows differently anyway. I mean, I've already had tens of people tweet at me about, like, will the show be available online? Can I stream it? I don't like watching TV, or I don't have TV anymore. I don't have cable. I need it online. So, I mean, as long as people are talking about it, or, you know, talking about what they saw, or just even one segment of it, to me, that's success, because I'm not selling ad money, so I don't mind if anybody tunes in or doesn't tune in. What I care really about is that people are talking about the issues that we talked about, or people are laughing at, you know, watching Blake Griffin play Papa Shot with me, or like that kind of stuff, to me, is what would make the show a success.
Someone might care.
After this interview.
Well, you know, I mean, hopefully you'll at least last till March 15th. Someone might care, but you know, that's neither here nor there. All right, lastly, I'll get you out of here on this. Who are your maybe top three dream guests for Garbage Time when it comes to celebrity guests on the show?
All right, top three. I hate top three because I'll think of like three that I missed and I'll call you later and be like, oh my God, wait, Abby.
Three and a half is fine.
I would say Tom Brady and or Gronk. I want those to count as one because we'd never, ever get both, and either would be great. Rob Ryan.
Rob Ryan, really?
I have a gigantic crush on Rob Ryan. It's a long-running... He is my soulmate, and I'd like to have him on the show and go on like a candlelit dinner date and discuss our future plans together.
That's my guy, Saints defensive coordinator. He's under a lot of pressure this year. He's got to turn that defense around.
I know, and I am willing to help him through whatever he needs. If he's really your guy, as in he's your buddy, go ahead and give him a call and tell him that he's wanted. I mean, we might not be able to fit him in the studio, but we will try.
I'll see what I can do. All right, what's that? The final dream guest then?
Oh, the final dream guest. This is very difficult. I would say since both two are all sports, we have to go outside of sports. It's hard because my brain has already adapted to like setting my standards. So like the things like dream guests, like the Tom Brady's of the world, I've already told myself like, nope, not gonna happen. You got to start aiming for like that guy who plays in that middle of the country hockey team and is on the fourth line.
So maybe out of that group, then who's the top name?
I would say let's go with Jon Stewart.
Ooh, Jon Stewart, I like that.
Yeah, that would be my third dream never going to happen guest.
All right, Katie Nolan, thanks for joining us today, having a good time. Garbage Time premieres March 15th, 9:30 Eastern on Fox Sports 1. Set your DVRs for it, watch it online. Help Katie Nolan and Awful Announcing and our plans to take over the world. That would be great. That would be fantastic. What can folks expect to see for the premiere? Do you have guests lined up already? Do you have an outline of what we might see?
We filmed our first guest yesterday, but I say it yet.
No one listens to this anyway. So I mean, just,
it's a comedian. It was an interview with a comedian, and we're also going to have. I think we've booked Vin Parisi to have a conversation about college basketball too. So those are some of the things you can expect.
Do we get like 3 guesses at who the comedian is?
If you want to, but you won't get it.
Kevin Hart?
Nope.
Man, he's everywhere. I thought for sure it'd be him. That was literally the only guess I had, so I guess I'll have to stop.
Well, then nope. Then no and no and no to all 3 of you.
All right. Okay. All right. Garbage Time again, March 15th, 9:30, Fox Sports 1. Follow Katie Nolan on Twitter at Katie Nolan. Should be easy enough to remember. And be nice to one another out there. I think Jerry Springer made that famous, so maybe that's an appropriate name to end the podcast on. All right, Katie. Thanks for joining us. Best of luck. Hopefully, we'll touch base again soon.
Thank you for having me, Matt. Take care.